From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest is Dr. Albert Chun, who we pre-taped last week. And here for you now is that taped conversation. Enjoy.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Peripheral artery disease is the narrowing of peripheral arteries due to atherosclerosis, which is that plaque buildup on arterial walls. It decreases blood flow to legs, feet, and toes. And left untreated, this disease, PAD for short, has complications that include critical limb ischemia, gangrene, and amputation. Joining us from a healthcare company, Modern Vascular, to talk about this topic and solutions is Dr. Albert Chun. He's a board-certified vascular and interventional radiologist specialist. And we welcome you, Dr. Chun, to Cool Science Radio. Great to have you.
Thanks. It is awesome to be here.
You've had a lot of practice over the last 15 years, instructor of radiology at Harvard University, assistant professor of radiology and surgery at George Washington University. You work with Modern Vascular, which is coming up with ways to treat PAD. I suppose you just call it PAD all the time and not peripheral artery disease.
Yeah, PAD is what most people go called. Yeah.
Right. 8 to 12 million people have peripheral artery disease. I've never heard of it. I mean, we know that heart disease is all about atherosclerosis, but how do you have PAD and not just arteriosclerosis and have, you know, the resulting heart attack?
It's actually a very similar disease process between the two. And although the peripheral designation refers generally to arteries outside of the heart, pathophysiologically, it's the same process that people have heard of outside of the world of medicine, known as hardening of the arteries or atherosclerosis. And it affects other arteries outside of the coronary arteries. To be sure, the thing that is most likely to be lethal about peripheral, if you have peripheral arterial disease, is that hardening of the arteries in the heart. But as you mentioned, there are symptoms that you can have outside of the heart, you know, even if you never have that heart attack, hopefully, that you can have pain in your legs with walking that can progress to pain at rest. If you're unlucky and you have slow healing wounds in your legs, that could, in the worst cases, progress to need for minor or major amputation.
So we know that those who suffer from diabetes also have a greater occurrence of PAD. Is that why you hear of so many people with diabetes having amputations, getting gangrene? Is it all due to PAD or is it another reason?
So the funny thing of it is the pattern of, so diabetes is a major risk factor, but it's just one of a few different risk factors for developing PAD. And so, you know, the other common ones are things like age, advancing age, hypertension, high cholesterol, smoking is a big modifiable risk factor. The peculiar and nasty thing about the diabetic type of PAD is that it tends to affect the smaller arteries. And anyone with diabetes knows other places in the body that have small arteries are the eyes, the heart, the kidneys, you know, these are, you know, and the toes. So it's nasty because it affects the small arteries in the body. And it's very tricky. It's a tricky spot if you're at sort of the end of the circulatory line. It limits options. You know, for years we didn't have the tools to even get down there to try to open up these arteries. Even now, just because it is sort of the end of the circulatory line, options like bypass that you might have in if you're upstream and have a blockage aren't on the table. And so, you know, the first line, of course, is always going to be things like modifying the risk factors that you can modify. You know, manage your diet, manage your blood sugar, control your cholesterol. If you smoke, quit smoking. That's always first line. Once you have the blockage in your arteries and it becomes symptomatic or problematic in other ways, that's when you need help.
Albert, what is currently the best way to test for plaque in the arteries?
So there's a lot of different ways to, so I'm going to be careful about how I answer that. But I, you know, the gold standard in terms of imaging is going to be an angiogram. But really, before there's a lot of steps that come before that. A physical exam, you know, screening based on risk factors. If imaging is required, and a non-invasive test such as ultrasound can be very, very useful. You know, there are a lot of steps before you get to the angiogram. But the angiogram, it's a minimally invasive test. It's essentially an X-ray test. is probably the gold standard even in 2021 for imaging the small arteries in question. But as I said, there's a bunch of steps that come before that.
And if any of our listeners have the risk factors that you've spoken about a little bit anyway, you know, smoking and diet and, you know, those sorts of things, would they be able to get a complete angiogram testing and have it paid for by their insurance?
Generally speaking, yes. But just like for other kinds of ailments, you really need to fit certain criteria to move on to the next step. So you want to modify risk factors that you can modify. You want to be on a walking program. If you're not on a walking program, you need to try to quit smoking, you know, manage your blood sugar, manage your cholesterol, the things that we just talked about. But once you reach a point of having a symptomatic blockage, which we briefly mentioned, things like pain at rest or wounds that are slow to heal, you need some help beyond the conservative management things that we described. And that's where minimally invasive options can potentially be useful. And in those cases, an angiogram is appropriate.
I wanted to ask you about the coronary calcium score. Is that the right term for it? It's another test that my doctor suggested that I get just because I wanted to have a baseline of where I was. What do you think about that test?
So I'm no longer a diagnostic radiologist, but I will say, and so this is slightly outside of my scope, but it falls into the category of non-invasive testing that can help if you have risk factors. It ultimately doesn't replace, if you need intervention, an angiogram. But that's a little bit out of my scope.
Okay, that's fair. I was just kind of curious because it had happened to me.
Yeah.
What is interventional radiology?
That is well within my scope. So interventional radiology is a medical specialty. We are medical doctors. You go to 4 years of medical school. And after that, we've all got 6 to 7 years of specialty training. It's an independent specialty. Where we learn both diagnostic imaging and interventional radiology, which is a way to use that imaging to guide all kinds of treatments for literally from head to toe. So anything from the acute, like stroke treatments or trauma, to subacute treatments like drains of all sorts, cancer treatments. It's extremely robust, and we work independently and with all kinds of other specialists to treat literally every part of the body.
Well, that sounds fascinating. How long has that been in practice?
So the inventor, or the father, I should say, of interventional radiology was a man named Charles Dotter, who is widely credited as the inventor of angioplasty, or tried the first successful angioplasty. He's a pretty famous. There's two famous guys in radiology, in interventional radiology, in two famous years that you ask any interventional radiologist in my line of work. One is 1895. That's when Wilhelm Röntgen discovers X-rays by accident. And the other is 1964. And that's when Charles Dotter does the first angioplasty. It's sort of interventional radiology lore, if I can nerd out a little bit on your podcast, that he treated a woman by the name of Laura Shaw, who was 82 years old at the time, and did this dilation of an artery famously on one side and not on the other that was treated by another physician, and managed to keep that leg from getting gangrene. And this lady kept her leg and walked around until she passed 3 years later. And that was sort of the first successful angioplasty. And there's a freestanding division of interventional radiology called the Dotter Institute, named after Dr. Dotter at Oregon Health Sciences University. So not quite your neck of the woods, but closer to you than me.
Okay, good. Well, you have certain tools in your tool bag that you use to help your patients. But we also know that computers are getting more performant every year, and imaging software is really, really getting more sophisticated, and it's increasing. And we also know that the technology companies will go to some people in the medical community and talk about their future intentions to see if they're on the mark or not for what they're shooting for. Is there any technology that will be out in the next 10 years that you're really excited about?
Wow, that's a great one, because there's all, you know, interventional radiology specifically, you know, SIT has sort of been on the forefront of developing sort of minimally invasive technology for, again, going on 60 years. And, you know, within the PAD realm, you know, the holy grail is, you know, how do we open closed arteries and leave no trace, right? How do you leave no scar and no plaque, and, you know, optimally, you know, no device such as a stent. And so, you know, it's trial and error, and it's evolved from balloon to stent to balloons and stents that have, they're coated with different kinds of medications,
right?
To devices that will pulverize the plaque and aspirate it. So the next wave, the dream in terms of this narrow scope that we're talking about, are things like stents that dissolve over time, you know, so that they're there to kind of prop the artery open for a little while, and the scaffolding will dissipate. So that's just a little bit of a nod of things that might be on the forefront in this space.
Well, it doesn't sound minimally invasive to me. I do like the idea of reaming out the plaque and then extracting it from the artery. That sounds like the way to really make the problem go away. But is Modern Vascular, the company that you work with, to that point yet? I know that they talk about balloons and stents and the drug-coated stents and that sort of thing.
Yeah, these are devices that exist now. They're all different flavors, everything from rotating blades to lasers. I know that sounds kind of Star Wars-y, but that all goes through an incision that doesn't require any stitches. I tell people, if you think about dry, uncooked spaghetti, one strand is about the size of the wires and catheters that we're generally using for these sorts of things. And you can't feel the drill.
Mm-hmm. So are all of these procedures outpatient procedures for the most part?
So they can be done inpatient or outpatient. The trend, as these devices have become sort of smaller and slicker, has been to do these outpatient, which especially over the last year has been useful in sort of offloading, you know, patient volume from inpatient centers. So yeah, it's the trend has been to perform these sorts of procedures as sort of a day procedure, almost like a colonoscopy.
So I went on the Modern Vascular website. There's a lot of good information there. And one of the things that they had there was a little quiz that you could take to see if you were at risk or to see if you should go in and talk to those folks. And there's 12 questions. And on those 12 questions, I answered 3 of them positively. One was, I'm over 50 years old. Another one was, I smoked, but only up until when I was about 30 years old. And another one that I was positive on, do you have wounds or ulcers on your foot or lower leg? And I have this one little thing between two toes that just won't heal, but I think it's mostly because I'm playing too much golf and hiking too much. But anyway, I got a score of 16, and with those, based on those 3 answers and the other 9 answers, which I said negative, you know, I don't have diabetes, I don't have a history of hypertension, those sorts of things. And they said, based on that, I had a score of 16, and anything over 10, I should come in and see them. Does that sound a little extreme, or do I sound at risk?
I think it's the way that I would put that is, well, first of all, the thing that I think sort of pings my radar as a physician when I hear that is, sure, wounds that are slow to heal between the toes. That doesn't mean you need to drop what you're doing and run to an emergency room. But I think it's probably reasonable combined with other risk factors, notably even remote smoking. So even if you quit 20 years ago, you can still have the effects on your arteries, you know, for today from smoking, even years ago. It's worth having an evaluation is what that means. And that, and we sort of talked about the non-invasive, you know, testing and physical examination and sort of more in-depth risk factor assessment, including just simply feeling pulses in the feet. So even if none of that results in further action, it's just having those things makes it worth having a baseline so that hopefully not, but in 10 years, if there's a change, you had a snapshot in time from today of whether things are better, worse, or the same.
And some of those spaghetti strands that you use are to position a stent or position, you know, some sort of therapy. But sometimes when you use those, it's just to go up and just take a peek. Is that correct?
So you can do just a diagnostic angiogram, if I'm understanding your question correctly, and not intervene. It's possible to do that. In the best case circumstance, I'm not taking those pictures unless there's a pretty high chance of finding something that we need to fix. Although diagnostic angiography by itself is safely done for all different kinds of reasons on an outpatient basis, it's not a non-invasive test. So the way to balance out that slightly increased risk of having a minimally invasive procedure is to be doing something else while you're there. And so it's worth it to have the angiogram. In medical jargon, we say when there's a high pretest probability of disease, right? In other words, I'm doing this picture to get better measurements or better characterize a blockage that I suspect is already there.
And while we're up there, we're going to do something.
But there is a better, you know, you can, it should be better than a coin toss that you're going to actually be doing something. In other words, we try not to do, to look just to look, right? Okay. Because that's what we should be accomplishing in the non-invasive setting. But yes, you can take pictures with those catheters.
Albert, what I was wondering is without having to put a catheter into someone, could we inject something into someone, a camera, and let it kind of go through the system and Wi-Fi be able to capture pictures without the catheter?
So yes, the closest thing to that would be special kinds of CAT scans where after they inject what we call contrast, which is an iodine-based solution into the IV, which many people have had, is to take, and that's known as a CT angiogram or computed tomography angiogram. That's pretty close, but that is generally a snapshot in time, a static image. You have to make some inferences about how things are really moving. And I tell people it's like the difference between a roadmap and a traffic camera, right? So if you see a snapshot from a traffic cam, not live video, you can infer that there is an accident or a back of a traffic if it's six lanes across and all the side roads are full, right? And if there's one car out there, you can assume things are moving pretty quickly. But it's not quite the same as watching the video, right? Because that one car could be at a dead stop, or then that six lanes of traffic could be moving 70 miles an hour. There, you do lose something for having the static image from the CAT scan and not having a sort of a real-time X-ray image that the angiogram provides. But the closest thing to what you're describing that's in common use today is a CT angiogram. There are also some limitations in terms of seeing the smaller blood vessels that, in question in particular that affect diabetics, as we mentioned. And so there are, the techniques are a lot better in terms of imaging those smaller arteries today than they were 10 years ago. But in common usage, your average CT angiogram for the smaller vessels in the feet is going to be not quite as good as a formal angiogram.
Right. Okay, thank you. Good answer.
Dr. Albert Chun is our guest. He is talking to us from Modern Vascular. Just before we let you go, and we're out of time, but I wanted to know, as an interventional radiologist, what are the projects that you are specifically working on? You're no longer in diagnostics, but you're working for a healthcare technology company. So what are your daily tasks?
So, you know, the way that we affect blood vessels in interventional radiology usually boils down to opening arteries that are closed, closing arteries that are too open, treating things when there's too much or too little blood flow. And there are other parts of the body where we can sort of affect that blood flow. An established one that, you know, has moved to the outpatient world from the hospital system is treating uterine fibroids in a non-surgical manner through a procedure called uterine fibroid embolization. And that similar concept is finding traction in other parts of the body for other disease processes, things like limiting inflammation in the knees to treat knee pain, or reducing the size of prostate volume in people with benign prostatic hypertrophy. So those are some of the sorts of things that we're sort of branching out into in outpatient land.
Just a really quick question for you, Albert. Somebody goes into the doctor's office and they make an appointment with a podiatrist because they have foot pain. Are podiatrists trained? Are they educated to diagnose and to help understand if someone has PAD or not?
Sure. I think most healthcare professionals have some ability to understand what the risk factors for PAD are and to get someone in front of an interventional radiologist if that person needs more help.
Well, Dr. Chun, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, well, thanks. I appreciate
it. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. And hey, tune in next week.